Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Oshman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 191, Jewish Kids Groups. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rothberg.
And before we jump into our series on Jewish education, which we've started around this time because it's the beginning of the school year, we want to just mention again that it's also the beginning of the Jewish year, and Yom Kippur just passed. We hope you had a meaningful and reflective experience on Yom Kippur, and that you're looking forward to Sukkot coming up. And if you celebrate that in a particular way, we hope you'll have a great celebration. And if you don't, it's probably something that we should take up on Judaism Unbound next year to see if we can try to reimagine Sukkot in a way for all the people out there who probably don't celebrate that holiday. In any event, we hope that you're having a great start to the Jewish year. And I wanted to mention one more time that because people often like at the beginning of the Jewish year to support the Jewish organizations that they're part of during the year, we wanted to suggest that you might take this opportunity to begin to support Judaism Unbound if you're not already a supporter. One way that we wanted to throw out and remind people about is that you can sign up to be a regular monthly contributor. You just have to sign up once. You can either use Patreon or PayPal, and you can access both of those opportunities at our website, www.judaismunbound.com/donate, where you can also make a one-time donation. So if you think that Judaism Unbound is worth a cup of coffee or two per month, you could sign up for something like $5 a month, and we would be extremely grateful to you for doing that. So thanks so much. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Our guests today are Anna Robbins and Neshama Littman. They're from an organization based in Atlanta called Jewish Kids Groups, which bills itself as a reimagined, reinvented, and ridiculously cool Hebrew school. Jewish Kids Groups is an after-school education program that operates 6 days a week, every weekday after school and also on Sundays. It describes itself as an independent network of Jewish supplementary schools that educate and inspire children in a way that feels like summer camp, engendering joyful Jewish identity, learning, and friendships. So there's a real connection to our conversation last week with Avi Orlo about Jewish summer camp. Our first guest, Anna Robbins, is the founder and executive director of Jewish Kids Groups. Anna has a master's degree in education, instructional design, and technology from Georgia State University, and she was working as an academic researcher before she started Jewish Kids Groups. Jewish Kids Groups has been named one of the most innovative Jewish organizations in America by the Slingshot Guide, and Anna has also been a participant in some of the most prestigious incubators and accelerators in the Jewish world. And our second guest, Neshama Littman, is the Jewish Kids Group Sunday Families Director. In that role, they're in charge of the Sunday program at Jewish Kids Group. And Neshama also runs the Jewish Kids Group's B'nai Mitzvah program. Jewish Kids Groups has all sorts of programs for a variety of different ages. As we'll discuss, you can go every day, you can go only on certain days, you can go on Sundays, and they even have a leadership program for teenagers. Neshama plays a critical role in developing the educational thinking of the Jewish Kids Groups, and particularly runs the Sunday program and the B'nai Mitzvah program. Neshama grew up in an interfaith family in Washington, D.C. and rural North Carolina, has a BA in music from UNC Chapel Hill, and spent much of their life at a Quaker camp on a working farm. We're excited to jump into this episode and learn more about Jewish Kids Groups and everything that it means for the future of Jewish education. So Anna Robbins, Neshama Littman, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
It's an honor to be here.
So Anna, you are the founder of Jewish Kids Groups. I think it's been around for about 7 years now. Can you tell us the story of who you were when it started, a prominent Jewish educator who came up with the new idea, or what was the story behind the founding of Jewish Kids Groups?
Yeah, it's I love thinking about the founding of Jewish Kids Groups now, especially as we're in this phase of very strategic development with our organization now. And the founding was much more related to happenstance. I was a researcher at the Institute for the Study of Modern Israel at Emory University, and I also taught Sunday school on the side at a local synagogue. And I was interested in questions around Israel education for young students, and I was trying to get out of my Sunday school gig. And someone at the Institute received a call from a local neighborhood parent saying, can we do something cool and Jewish for our kids after school? In fact, her exact quote was, my Jewish kid is picking his nose on the soccer field every day after school for $100 an hour. Is there something cool and Jewish we could do instead? And I was interested in the question both because of my academic interests and because I was trying to get out of this Sunday school gig I was teaching. And we started something just very small, and I thought of it as collecting research for on young learners in Israel education. And it started out just being like six kids after school in a garage, and it very quickly ballooned sort of out of control to something I couldn't manage as a side gig. We quickly had 65 students. But again, I was a professional working at Emory. This isn't what I was trying to do. And I had this annoying parent who was sort of always pinging me about it. She sort of said, there's this incubator program in Israel you should go to. I'm like, okay, thanks for your input, lady. And went back, you know, to my job and sort of doing minimum viable for this group of now 65 kids. And she pinged me again a few weeks later and said, like, the deadline has passed. I wanted to check in to see if you applied for this incubator, to which I said, like, no, thank you so much. I'm actually have a full professional job and just do this on the side. And she wrote back again, this annoying parent, and said, I don't know them, but I really think this is something you should explore. If I call this organization in Israel and ask for an extension on the application, would you consider applying? And I sort of, to shut her up, said, yes, like, who cares? The deadline's passed. This isn't anything. This ended up being the present tense fellowship application. And almost immediately at looking at the application, I realized, like, not only did I want to be in this accelerator, this was sort of what I wanted to do. So that annoying parent is now one of my closest friends. And I think Daniel also recognized the name. That was Jenny Rivlin Roberts.
A past guest on the show.
Oh, okay. There you go. Great. Yeah, so that was really the beginning of all of this, and I'll share just a personal story that I worked for Ken Stein, for Professor Ken Stein at Emory University, and I went into his office and I said, Ken, this thing has like blown up. It has 65 kids now. I'm really sort of above capacity, but I want to explore this. I want to go to Israel for 6 weeks and think about whether or not this should really be a nonprofit and whether or not I should really dive into this. And he, without flinching, said, you can go, but you won't have a job when you come back. And so it was like very clear in that. Now, that didn't end up being true. I did work for him for another year, but it's sort of a funny story of me having, at that moment, I sort of had to make the decision, like, do I want to try this or not?
So I think there's like probably three points in time that we want to explore over the course of this podcast. You know, one is before that accelerator, one is maybe during that accelerator when some initial strategy got created, you know, and then after what's happened, how have things changed? But I want to start back at that time before the accelerator, because it's kind of fascinating that all of a sudden there's 65 kids. So I'm wondering, as you saw it, as you see it, two things that I think have to combine with any initiative like that. One is, what is the need that you think you were serving at that time? Who are these 65 kids? Why were they coming to some random person's garage for Hebrew school when there are probably all kinds of other options available? And number two, what is it that you had in your mind that you were doing differently that they were responding to?
So in terms of what we were doing, let's start there. I just want to stress that it was not super intentional in the beginning. It was really me like Googling in the car on the way what to do for second graders for Sukkot. And my basic like bar was, you know, was this something I did in Hebrew school? If so, we're probably not going to do it. And like, does this position kids to use their hands to learn? And that was because in the beginning we were picking them up from school at the end of a busy day when they like hadn't had, you know, eaten for 4 hours and their friends were at soccer and there was just like a lot of competition in terms of their attention and their attention span at that time. I want to just ground this all in the fact that it wasn't haphazard in the sense that I just decided this should happen. It was very much grounded in research. Again, that's what I did at the time. So from the earliest phase when I had maybe, I'm making it up now, but 7 kids or 15 kids, I started holding focus groups. Remember, I was also trying to tie this into my work at the Institute at the time. So I was holding focus groups of parents and doing research outside of that to sort of build a case. And in fact, in one of these focus groups, the idea emerged of a 5-day-a-week Jewish after-school program. And the basic problem, a parent raised their hand and said, like, my problem is we have two-parent working family. School lets out at 2:30. My kids need after-school care. And then I'm supposed to figure out how to, like, schlep them to something else Jewish, either on Sunday or later in the week. And, like, that just doesn't work for me. And suddenly the room was silent. And then, like, 100 other people said, like, yeah, me too. So I was just facilitating the session. I didn't think I would be founding an organization at this point. I didn't have big aspirations. I was just the researcher and the facilitator. And so as a good facilitator would, I said, like, oh, wow, there's a lot of consensus in the room about this. And I just have to say, like, this is sort of such an obvious idea. It must exist other places. You guys can count on me to do a national environmental scan, and then I'll come back with the data. And maybe there's, like, an opportunity for someone in Atlanta to copy something that exists somewhere else. That was in 2010. I did an environmental scan that summer, and zero five-day-a-week Jewish after-school programs with this model existed. The reason that's fascinating is because when we launched our five-day-a-week Jewish after-school program in 2012, two or three other programs around the country independently launched at the same time. So for me, that was incredibly validating. It also just demonstrated that this phenomenon of two-parent working families who want something Jewish was not unique to Atlanta.
So I just want to be clear, when you say a five-day-a-week Jewish after school, that doesn't mean that kids have to come 5 days a week. Could you talk a little bit about what it does mean?
Yeah, that's great. So families have the option to send their kids between 2 and 5 days a week. It can be any 2 days of your choosing. And our goal is always to get you to more days. Something like 80% of our audience come either 4 or 5 days a week. So that is certainly the most popular option. The reason the flexibility is important to us is so that you can opt into soccer in fall and then come right back to Jewish kids groups in the spring. It, of course, does complicate the curriculum, just meaning that it's super important to me that kids are never hearing the same thing, not experiencing the same activities 2 days in a row, on the one hand. And it's very important to me that the kids who are coming 2 and 3 days a week don't feel like they're missing 2 or 3 days a week.
You talk about over and over on your website and other places, like, this should be fun and this should be ridiculously cool is the tagline that I see a lot. And I want to hear more about that. Like, what, so on the one hand, like, I sense a response to other kinds of Sunday school, Hebrew school situations. You mentioned your own experience growing up. If you had X in Hebrew school, you're probably not going to do it as part of this one. So I sense in that fun, ridiculously cool languaging, an implicit statement. Maybe you wouldn't pose it as like a challenge or a response, but like a statement that that's not always what it is in people's Hebrew schools. But I want to hear, like, why is it so imperative that a Jewish educational experience be fun, be ridiculously cool? I keep on flashing to Zoolander, really, really ridiculously good looking, ridiculously cool. Why is it important for that to be the case? And what does it look like to actually put the pieces together where it is? Because I think a lot of places would like to be fun and cool, but yeah. Like, give us your teachings on how it happens.
I want to talk about that because it is such a like tagline. And I think it's very reflective of what we're doing. I do also have a reaction to it. And the reason is because I think it can sound like very salesy. So I want to first talk about why we have that tagline and like why we have that approach. So with regards to the term ridiculously cool, like this very salesy term actually stemmed out of our desire to be authentic. And I just want to tell you a little bit about who makes up Jewish kids groups so you can have a better sense of like what's going on here. So we are all Jews in our 20s and 30s who love being Jewish, like authentically, whether some of us went to Jewish summer camp, some of us have been very engaged in Limud, others of us have come out of Moshe House and like many of the programs you know about. And we think Judaism has made our life better. So like that's the basic premise that we're starting from. We're not starting from a premise of like, we've got to make this look cool and we've got to be cheerleaders and we have to convince people. We really feel this authentically, and our opportunity that we have is to bring this to the next generation. Everything we do is informed by best practices we've seen in other seen and read in other successful Jewish organizations. And I'll talk specifically about like what about Jewish kids groups resembles camp, this is a like sort of a buzz phrase now in supplemental Jewish education, which is like our Sunday school feels like camp. And so I just want to talk with you a little bit about like what we, so what we did is we isolated out what we think are the things, the actual elements of summer camp that make it the successful and impactful experience it was. And then we looked at which of those can we pull into a year-round program. So just off the cuff, when we were looking at the research around summer camp and thinking about our own experiences, the number one thing that impacted us was relationships. So that's both strong friendships and strong relationships with counselors. Another element of Jewish summer camp is the hands-on experiential nature of it. It's not that you're learning because you're like looking at a board or watching someone else do something. You're learning both because you're playing with the topic and also because there's time. There's time to like make the side joke to your friend, and there's time to bring the joke back around to what happened yesterday. And there's time to remember your friend's dog's name. And there's this luxury of time. And that's closely related to another thing that we see as a pillar of summer camp, which is the immersive nature of it. The immersive nature of it, it means that like Shabbat is natural. Everyone's doing Shabbat. And it means you're like brushing your teeth next to your Jewish friend. And I want to emphasize one thing that's unique about Jewish kids groups, which is that almost all of our programming is mixed age group. And we see these really interesting relationships being formed between our kindergartners and our fifth graders. There's a funny story of a student in kindergarten who was having a summer birthday and was telling her mom the birthday list. And she's naming all these fifth grade boys. And the mom of the kindergarten girl says like, I don't know if Max is going to want to come to your princess birthday party. And Sila said like, oh no, he's going to want to. And sure enough, all these fifth graders showed up at her birthday. And it was like, you know, for her, those are like the much cooler older kids. But we've really created a dynamic in the after school where there can be those inter quote unquote generational relationships between kids. So it's the friend piece, it's the counselor piece that is really important, consistent older role models who are worthy of being role models. The immersion piece, our kids are there, can be up to 20 hours a week.
I think that community piece is the most important part of after school because anything can be fun. Like you can go to a concert and jump around for a while with other kids, like go to a kid's concert and it's fun and it can be ridiculously cool, but you don't necessarily walk away feeling like you're part of a community. And the JKG after school has structures in place that reinforce that sense of community. So for example, one thing they do is they have Zman Kehila, which is like community time. So all the kids are sitting in a circle. And before they announce the activities for the day, they do shout out moments. So it's an opportunity for the kids to shout out their friends for doing kind things for them and to shout out the counselors and for counselors to shout out the kids. And hearing very young children articulate without being prompted, articulate something that they really appreciated that another child did for them or that an adult did for them is really beautiful and also feels like so fundamental to real community.
Before we get on to some of the content of the curriculum, the aims of education that you have, I just want to ask you about for whom is a 5-day a week Hebrew school good? Who is looking for that? Does it have to do, do you find that it has to do primarily with people who have two working parents and are looking for something after school and there's transportation, so it's kind of easy and predictable? Or do you find that there are a lot of people who actually are looking for a 5-day a week Jewish program for some Jewish reason?
Right.
Or is it some combination of all those? But I guess I'm really trying to get at that so much of what you've talked about, whether it was accidental or intentional, is based on research, or that research is a significant part of your orientation. So I'm wondering what you can share with the world.
Sure.
In terms of the research that you're doing here, because I think that people would assume that there's no market for a 5-day a week Hebrew school, and yet there is. So why is there?
Well, not only is there is in multiple markets, and a handful of years later, we're all showing proof of concept. I know there's also a 5-day a week Jewish after school program, and DC and in Berkeley and in Philly and in Chicago. So I want to start by saying Jewish Kids Groups was designed to serve unaffiliated and interfaith families. And the reason that was our target market was because the research we were looking at showed that nationally, about 60% of all Jewish school-age children do not receive any formal Jewish education. So just to give you some background, I know we talk a lot about day schools, and this is a shocking statistic, so I'm going to say it slowly, but about 4% of Jewish children attend day schools, and 37 attend part-time Jewish education programs. That leaves a whopping 59, 60% who do not attend any Jewish education. So when we created Jewish Kids Groups, we wanted to go after this 60%. We were trying to create a new audience. And initially, we were very successful with that. There's a few unique characteristics of after school that sort of helped to determine who we're serving that I want to share with you. So we set out to serve unaffiliated and interfaith families. And initially, that was who we attracted. And when sort of the buzz, when word got out about the caliber and quality of our program, we also started attracting synagogue members. The number one thing that determines whether or not someone will attend a Jewish after-school program is where they live. So I've told you about these schools in different communities. Each one is serving like the 5 to 10 elementary schools closest to them. After that, I'll say like we are successful. Of course, anyone who like is looking for a premium Jewish education, this is the best option for them. So like highly affiliated conservative families. This year, we're serving a new handful of families actually from the Orthodox community. So these are families who are opting into public school this year and looking for Jewish content afterwards. Still, about 70% of the families we're serving today are not affiliated with a synagogue. In that, there's a mix of families who are just looking for premium after school programming. And like the fact that they happen to have one Jewish parent is like a nice coincidence, and that's fine. I sort of think of them as my bait and switch audience. So I'm selling them on this organic snack and this like delicious community. And then when their kids get there, we like get them super engaged in Judaism. And then they're going home and like telling, dusting the candlesticks off from the attic and things like that. And then another part of the audience, like even we have families who are choosing the public schools in this neighborhood now because there's this Jewish after school option.
When these folks get off the van / bus / mode of transportation that they are utilizing to get to JKG, JKG flows really nicely. I'm just going to JKG, Jewish Kids Groups. What's the content? I mean, I'm curious, you know, would you describe the content of your Jewish education as like sort of roughly similar to what people expect, but just you're doing it with your own twist, with your own camp vibe, with your own ridiculously cool set of dynamics? Or would you say that actually from a curricular standpoint, you're highlighting different pieces of Jewish education than you might expect to find in some synagogue schools and some day schools?
I would say largely we're teaching the same content, but our emphasis is on kids living Judaism. So they're like living out Jewish values. They're living into the expression of Jewish holidays rather than being taught about those things. So our curriculum focuses on Jewish values, Jewish holidays, various Jewish cultures. And the benefit of having, as Anna was saying, this luxury of time in after school is that the program is organized around like week-long topics. So if they're studying Sukkot for a full week, every day they have like 3 peulot options, 3 lesson options. And each of those options hits different learning modalities. So by the end of the week, there will be 15 options for learning about Sukkot, and they only choose one each day.
I wanted to give an example just to like illuminate what Neshama is saying about the different peulot activities, because I think in addition to the content question, it's interesting to ask how the setup of the day is different than another kind of Jewish education based on the fact that these kids have been in school all day. So for us, another aspect of summer camp that we're trying to mimic is choice, high quality choices. So let me just give you a rundown on the schedule, and then I want to talk about like a Sukkot example specifically. So from the moment when the kids arrive, the first activity is Shulchanot. And that is, there's an activity happening at each different shulchan table, or in shulchanot, they're choosing between the tables what they want to do. So from the moment we walk in, we're trying to break them. We're trying to break what happened at school and come into Jewish kids groups. And it's like, hang your backpack on the hook with your name on it, take your shoes off and choose which activity you're going to do at which shulchan you're going to be. From there, we moved to Zman Kila, which Neshama referenced. The thing, in addition to shout outs and a couple other routines they have there, the reason Zman Kila is a really exciting time of the day is it's the time that the students hear their pe'olot, the activities, they hear their choices for the day. And the way it sounds to students is each of their counselors will give a really animated rundown of what they're doing. So first we slip in the learning objectives. For example, if the learning objective for that day, because each day has a different learning objective so that we're not repeating content, is around the walls of a sukkah, for example, Jake might say, hey guys, as you guys know, I'm really into tie-dye. So for my pe'olah today, what we're going to do is we're going to be in the science room tie-dyeing sheets together, and we're going to build a community sukkah where the sheets are the solid walls, whatever. Katie might say, my group is cooking graham crackers today, and in fact, we're each going to build our own sukkah in the kitchen. The kids then get to choose their activities. And like any human, they're making their decision based on a variety of factors. Which activity sounds like the most fun? Which counselor do I love the most or like need some time with? Or like, where are my friends going? And those for us are all valid reasons to choose a pe'olah. Then at the end, we come back together and the group share their learning and experiences with each other. Again, like cultivating this community time. After that, they break into Ivrit groups. Everything in our Hebrew classes, Ivrit is Hebrew, everything in our Hebrew classes is done through games. So you might walk into Jewish kids groups and see that one group is playing Jenga with Hebrew phrases on each Jenga block. You might see that another group is giving each other instructions to how to get to the airport and using the key Hebrew words that they're learning. But everything is through games. We very rarely use worksheets or anything like that. After they go to Ivrit, then they go to the pe'olah activity that they chose during Zman Kihila. After that, we have Hafsaka, which is playground time. And then the most important part of the day for parents is Shiurei Bayit, homework time. So we find that one thing that's very important in this model is that kids go home with their homework finished.
Their homework from their school from the morning.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love to think more broadly about the aims of education for you, and also as you have had this experience, what you see as the aims of education or what the aims of education should be for particularly Jewish after school education. And we've heard descriptions so far, but I'd love to hear sort of globally how you think about what Jewish education ought to be for and how you've designed your program to try to achieve those goals.
One of our newest programs is a B'nai Mitzvah program. And I think that's traditionally been the aim of Jewish education, at least through synagogues, is to get kids to Bar Bat Mitzvah and then kind of nothing. There's no end game after that. And both of our programs are definitely leading towards the B'nai Mitzvah program, and it's an alternative program. So thus far, there is no rabbi involved. It's not held in a synagogue, and kids don't read from the Torah. The purpose of the program is for kids to develop their own personal ethic of what it means to walk through the world Jewishly informed. And I think that should be the aim of Jewish education, is to give kids some kind of roadmap for what Judaism and what Jewish tradition and what Jews have to say about society. I think all of us are Jews by choice. Like, it's very easy to choose to be in different parts of society. And I think for those of us for whom Judaism is really compelling, that's the piece that I want us to get across in our education, that Judaism is useful, not in and of itself, but because it has so many tools for us to use building a more just world. In the B'nai Mitzvah program, students, it's a two-year program, and students choose something that they're interested in already that's not necessarily Jewish. So it could be like Jewish video games or just like video games generally, and then we're going to figure out how to make it Jewish. And then they have to connect that to some social issue. So we have a list of like 20 social issues. And over the 2 years as a cohort, they work on translating these Jewish values that they've been learning about into stepping outside of JKG walls and working within the Atlanta community. And it's really important that they make those explicit connections between this Jewish value that tells me I have an obligation to take care of the stranger and of the vulnerable in my community. And here's this community farm that grows tons of vegetables to give to local homeless shelters. And my Jewish value tells me that my time spent volunteering for this farm and my time spent raising resources for this farm directly contributes to society, and that that links to something that I'm already interested in. Helping kids make those connections between something they are interested in because they want to be, not because anybody in their family tells them that they should be, with something Jewish and with something that feels like it contributes to society in a meaningful way.
And then what this all culminates in is actually a really, really beautiful beautiful and authentic coming of age experience. So it all culminates, this is after the kids have visited multiple community service projects in Atlanta. It's how, it's after we've shown them how the Jewish world is interfacing with social justice in Atlanta. And it's after they've done this deep dive on a specific project, whether it be investigating their family roots or whether it be the specific period in Jewish music in Europe or whether it be Jewish feminism. I'm just thinking of some of our projects. We had a really interesting one this past year. This student was interested in amulets and potions, and she did a deep dive into amulets and potions in the Torah. Anyway, this all culminates in a shared B'nai Mitzvah coming of age celebration in which the kids have their science fair boards displayed around the room. And the actual ceremony is each child giving a 30-minute sort of Shark Tank style pitch on their project to the 300 people gathered in the room. They get a personal blessing from their parents, and they watch their peers sort of go through this. And then together they lead a community Havdalah service, after which we have a party where the kids enjoy some of the more traditional elements that they're used to seeing in movies around the B'nai Mitzvah, including like dancing. We really have a big hora and dance the hora together, and every child is lifted in the chair. I have to say, I come from a very traditional synagogue background, and this was a really anxiety-producing program for us to create, because I so much in my own life see the value of being part of a synagogue and synagogue membership and intergenerational Jewish communities. And there are so many reasons I was worried about this. And what I personally experienced and what I have heard from so many guests over the years was that this was the most personal coming of age experience they've witnessed. So, you know, it's true. There's no rabbi and there's no service and there's so much there. This is not something the kids can just check off their list. This is like a legitimate year-long project where we're tracking with them and they're doing deep learning. Another student, part of her culminating project was leading the entire school in an effort to collect resources and pack bags to give homeless people outside the car window. And it ended up being this like unbelievable project that she coordinated for all our kindergarten, first grade, and second graders, and then took out into the world. And like, she also led a Mother's Day program somewhere where they did the same thing to help alleviate some of the challenges of homelessness. She also spent time on like a little homelessness trip on spring break, and like many elements to sort of inform her understanding and to deepen her connection and understanding of the issue.
That particular student is very Jewishly involved outside of JKG, and she was resistant to making her project Jewish. And I was like, it's fine. You can like study homelessness. And I just want you to know that Jewish tradition has a lot to say about homelessness. Like, it's okay if you don't want to explicitly engage with that in your own research, but let's have this series of conversations just so you know that this exists within your tradition. Whether or not you choose to engage with it, it's important that you know that it's there.
That's awesome. As an educator, I would like dream of a conversation that starts with, I don't really want to do a project that's Jewish. I want to talk about homelessness. It's like, oh my God, like, let's go.
Is that how every conversation starts? Like, often, yeah, kids are like, well, I don't know how to make this Jewish, but here's this other thing that I'm interested in.
But I think that's a tremendous failure of Jewish education more globally, right? And we were talking about it not so long ago, reimagining how we think about Jewish law, halakha, Jewish practice, whatever you want to call it. You know, and for me, the thing that was dominant in my mind was the idea that of recycling, which I don't consider a Jewish behavior at all, and yet I ought to. You know, why have things like that sort of never been said in a Jewish context? They actually tend to be looked at as not Jewish things because we don't say a bracha before we do them or whatever. Well, we could. And I think that sometimes the way that people feel put off by that idea is that when they hear we should look at homelessness or recycling through a Jewish lens, they hear you saying we should be looking at it exclusively through a Jewish lens. And then it feels like, oh, now you're taking my stuff and putting it into this little sandbox, you know, as opposed to saying a Jewish lens is one of the lenses through which we experience everything in the world. So,
yeah, I want to it's interesting. One of the best things that I learned in a Jewish education context was the recycling front. And I don't think that's normal, but I want to name and it was a summer camp thing. So here we are talking about how summer camp should imbue more into Jewish education. My camp gave out t-shirts with the phrase Schmutzbusters. There was a carrot, like in the carrot and stick sense, there was like a reward for if you were walking around camp and like picking up trash or recycling. It actually became a problem because kids were doing it so much that it became clear they were just doing it for the reward. But like the positive side is like I do have these associations of cleaning, of recycling, with Judaism. I agree that it's a failure.
Experiential, immersive, done with your friends, looking up to a counselor.
Yeah. And if you ask me like the most Jewish part of my camp, I would probably not think initially to say those t-shirts. I only got one or two over the course of my time, by the way. I wasn't the best at this, but it's right to say that is deeply Jewish. I wanted to target a question towards Neshama. This is a gear shift a bit, but I think it's worth bringing up. Kids are in the South. You're in Atlanta. I mean, Atlanta is an interesting place, and it's an urban environment on the one hand, and it's also like in Georgia and in the South. And I think that it's worth dwelling in that. And what I especially want to name is, in looking at your bios, something I'd never seen before was somebody in a Jewish context naming, I don't know, in your second sentence or third sentence, a deep love for the Southern Appalachian Mountains. There's a number of layers to what I love about that. One is that I think a lot of people are probably surprised to find like a Jewish educator who feels that way. It blends outdoors. It shows like there's so many things there. But I wanted to ask you, like, are there ways in which growing up, and I don't know your full background story, so to the extent that you can share a little, like, are there ways in which, you know, growing up in the Southern Appalachian Mountains plays into this work that are worth naming? We're here having a conversation about it, an Atlanta organization, and I want to sort of ground it if that's helpful.
I'm really glad that you brought the South up because I think, yes, we are in Atlanta, which is an urban space, and this is a solidly Southern city, and the Jewish community here is solidly Southern. It like feels different, it smells different than Northeastern Jewish communities. So I mostly grew up in the rural South, not so much in the mountains, but in other parts of North Carolina. And I'm from an interfaith family, and my non-Jewish mom is the reason that I am Jewishly identified, which is a longer story. Coming from an interfaith family and coming from a space where I was very acutely aware of being an outsider, you know, we have this relationship as Jews with being outsiders in society, and I think that's much more pronounced in the South. Working within a Southern Jewish space means that we're coming at the way that we engage with Jewish life differently. Like, we're not surrounded by people who have this implicit understanding of what Jewish life looks like. Like, if you were growing up in New York, you would get high holidays off from school and you would be surrounded by people who might not necessarily be Jewish, but definitely understood some Jewish words and like basic Jewish concepts. And in the South, there's a lot of misinformation about Jews, which sometimes feels terrifying. Like in Southern public schools, there's still kids that we're working with that they get bullied for being Jewish, but bullied in really interesting kind of like ancient ways of like asking about horns and talking about like Christians saying, I forgive you for killing Jesus. So our kids are really experiencing that feeling of being different in a visceral way. And I think it leads to some really hard internal struggles about whether or not they're proud of being Jewish, where they maybe are okay with being Jewish, but are also really inspired by values within secular society. And they're more quick to push back against like, well, this value of taking care of the poor, shouldn't that just be a universal value? What's Jewish about it? That kind of pushback is really useful for the Jewish community to have to like really articulate what is Jewish about taking care of the poor? What does it mean to hold something that's a universal value and also something that like Jews have a particular relationship with? I think that having a multitude of experiences with different communities makes my own experience with Judaism much more intense because I have always had to fight for it, to fight for my relationship with it, and also to fight for my identity inside and outside the Jewish community. So helping to create a rich Jewish identity for Southern Jews is like helping to add their voices back to the Jewish conversation. I think most of my friends who have grown up in the South feel like they kind of happen to be Jewish, and it feels like some kind of healing work to, especially with queer friends, to show them that Judaism has these radical elements, which if they had grown up in the Northeast, they might have been exposed to more radical Judaism. And in the South, those radical conversations are not happening. So we're definitely not teaching radical Judaism at JKG. And I think that it is radical to demand that kids engage with all of these issues that they're engaging in as part of a progressive community, to engage with those issues from an explicitly Jewish lens and do the hard work of wrestling with the pieces of Judaism and Jewish tradition and Jewish ritual that feel not progressive, like challenging them to wrestle with those things rather than just throw them out feels radical and feels like a movement towards helping them stay in the Jewish conversation. And a couple summers ago, not this summer, but last summer, I had the amazing opportunity to go to Queer Talmud camp through Sfara with B'nai Lappi. And it was intensely powerful to be in a room full of queer people who were in love with Jewish text and like really wanting to wrestle with the hard parts of the text and put our own complicated histories and narratives into the tradition. What are all the tensions and contradictions inherent in that?
So before we close, Anna, I'm curious about the implications of Jewish kids groups for the world of Jewish education, maybe for the wider world, because I'm thinking particularly about the economics of it. Because I guess I'm wondering to what extent is Jewish kids groups economically sustainable based on the people who go there, or to what extent you're still needing substantial philanthropic support. And I ask that only because I think that to the extent that we're in search of new ways of going about Jewish life and Jewish education, one of the important questions is, how do these new things get started? And what are the predicates for them getting started? What should funders expect in terms of their sustainability? And it seems to me that one of the really interesting things about Jewish kids groups is that it's trying to solve not only people's Jewish problems, but also people's childcare problems, right? And I might be willing to pay for childcare on an order of magnitude that I'm not willing to pay for Judaism, whatever judgment you might want to make about that. And so I'm curious, if you create an organization that really does serve people's extra Jewish needs, let's call them, in addition to or even exclusive of their Jewish needs, does that help you build a more stable economic organization? Or is it still something where we have to say the way this stuff is going to work is still going to be with philanthropists playing a significant role? And then my question, I guess, in light of what you've done, is how might philanthropists think differently about funding Jewish innovations such that organizations like yours could really thrive even more?
Yeah, So a few things on that. I like to think of Jewish Kids Group's after school community as an adjacency service. We have several really strong ones in the Jewish community. For example, PJ Library, right? That's basically saying parents are going to read books to their young children before they go to bed anyway. Let's make them Jewish books. You might put Moshe House in this category. Graduates are going to live together after college anyway. Let's make them Jewish graduates living together and running programming. And I see Jewish Kids Groups as part of that same train. Like, parents need after school care anyway. I think creating Jewish adjacency services is definitely a strong financial model. And 8 years in, we are still very much at the beginning of our organizational journey. That is to say, Jewish Kids Groups' goal is not to create great alternative Jewish experiences for Atlanta's kids. Jewish Kids Group's goal is to change the paradigm nationally for Jewish education. We think our best guess right now of what that means is spreading this after school model. So even at 8 years old, Jewish Kids Groups is A, still running multiple experiments, and B, has these national aspirations. At this juncture, we're generating about $500,000 in earned revenue, and the remainder of our budget is raised. That certainly will even out over time as we stabilize and transition from the sort of early startup experimenting phase to becoming what we're ultimately going to be. We will need philanthropy for many years going forward. Again, we're on the local, we're still piloting local when our real mission and vision is to create a national change.
So just as we close, I love when we have guests whose passion you can hear in their voice. I love it selfishly because we're a podcast and passion comes across vocally. I love it because it makes for good audio. But I mostly love it because it's refreshing and exciting to hear people who their job really matters to them. And there is this sense that you're, and certainly in education, that you're changing a lot of lives. And so just as we close, I'd love to get a sense, just what brings that passion into your voice? Like, what is it that you're so, what about this are you most proud of? Or what are some pieces that you're most proud of? What are some things that you'd love the world to know about what you've already started to achieve and what you might continue to achieve and grow in the future?
Yeah, this all stems from a very selfish place, which is just that Judaism really enriched my childhood and my adulthood. I'm obsessed with the idea that, like, how might I share it? What keeps me going and, like, the excitement you hear in my voice is, like, I am so thrilled to learn. I'm not the only person obsessed with this idea. We have an incredibly strong professional team here at Jewish Kids Groups. Everyone is young, everyone is excited, and we are all laser focused on this mission of exposing more Jewish kids to the benefits we had, both in childhood and adulthood, of being connected with the Jewish people. So my excitement is really about, like, I'm so glad I'm not alone in this passion. And I see that it's contagious. I see that my team really has it, and that trickles down to the counselors. And when it's authentic for the counselors, it's authentic for the kids. So in recent years, I've explored this idea that Avi Orlo set forth for me around Jewish summer camp. And he said that the secret of Jewish summer camp is the camp within the camp. That is, what investments are we making in the counselors to make this an authentically strong and worthwhile Jewish experience for them? And I hate to use the term trickle-down effect, but the idea that if it's authentic for us on the leadership team, and our counselors see that it is authentic for us and it's authentic for them, and their kids feel that too.
Thank you both so much for joining us. It's been a fantastic conversation.
Thank you all so much for the work you're doing. We're big fans of the podcast and are so grateful for sort of this canon of knowledge you are putting out there for now and in the future.
Canon of knowledge. I love that. Thank you. That's what we're trying to do. So I'm glad that it's resonating for you, and hopefully it's resonating for all of those folks out there listening. We hope that all of you enjoyed this episode, and we hope that you'll tune in again in the future. We want to close out this episode in the same way that we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a wide variety of ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can go to our Twitter feed at Judaism Unbound. Third, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can hit us up via email, dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. Either one, both of them, whatever works. The last request we like to make is that we really deeply appreciate any amount of financial donation that you are able to set aside and send our way. And you can do that via judaismunbound.com/donate on either a monthly recurring basis or just as a one-time gift. So thank you so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.